Morning all. So thank you for coming this morning to the Reserve Bank of Australia, especially on, I think it's the first day of school holidays, Monday morning, nice and early. I'd like to acknowledge first the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today. I pay my respects to their elders past and present, and extend that respect to all First Nations people present. Today I'm going to discuss the Monetary Policy Board's new framework for additional monetary policy tools at low interest rates. And we just published that rather fulsome framework alongside my short speech today. The framework helps us to prepare for any future episode in which the cash rate is very low. It draws on our recent experience during the pandemic, the experience of our peers at that time and before that, and the broader literature. We also tapped into, and I should, we owe a debt of gratitude to the helpful guidance of three external experts. That's Loretta Mester, Malcolm Eady, and Begonia Dominguez. The framework is a guide to making decisions about additional monetary policy tools. What it does is it sets out how we, the Monetary Policy Board, the RBA staff, would approach the design, the use of, and the exit from additional tools. It highlights the key judgments and decisions that the Monetary Policy Board would need to make. But the framework's not prescriptive. It can't be, because future shocks are unlikely to look like the pandemic or other crises overseas. And while today's focus is on these additional tools, the cash rate target remains our primary and preferred instrument for achieving low inflation and full employment. Now that's because it's well understood, it's highly effective. Indeed, during the pandemic, I would argue that the largest contribution we made to supporting the economy came from lowering the cash rate target to historically low levels and then keeping it there for some time. Additional tools can play an important role during extraordinary times and provide some extra support, but they're much more complex and they carry greater risks. Their effectiveness is also uncertain, and it depends, and that effectiveness depends on the context and the nature of the shock. So I'm going to start by introducing the framework, and then I'm going to turn to some of the observations from our previous use of additional tools. So the new framework stems from the RBA review and a commitment to help explain how the Monetary Policy Board would approach additional tools. But it also reflects changes to the RBA's governance and risk management, most notably the creation of separate governance and monetary policy boards. And the framework has four guiding principles, which are designed to support an effective and tailored policy response while taking careful account of the trade-offs and risks. So what are they? Well, first, any tool or package should contribute to the RBA's monetary policy objectives and be consistent with financial stability. Second, the expected benefits should be reasonable relative to the potential costs. Third, tools should be ready to use and sufficiently flexible. And fourth, the RBA should account for broader public sector policies and the consolidated public sector balance sheet while maintaining operational independence. So those are the four principles. The fourth one, though, I think is worth spelling out a little bit. If we talk to other agencies, that's going to help us make sure that our actions, any actions we're going to take, will fit well with theirs, while at the same time preserving our independence and their independence. There's two reasons for that. First, some additional tools transfer risks from the economy to the consolidated public sector balance sheet. In other words, the net assets and liabilities of all government agencies. And that's how they work. But those potential costs should be identified quite clearly. And second, when responding to a shock, it's important to consider the overall effect of different tools across all of their agencies. This includes how other agencies might respond, and whether there are important implications for any of the RBA's tools for their work. So the framework emphasises consultation with the Treasury, the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, and other relevant agencies. Now, that approach, I would argue, preserves central bank independence, but it allows the RBA to act decisively in pursuit of our mandate as needed, at the same time that it will ensure a common understanding of the nature of the shock to enable the most effective policy response. So how would we approach a future episode when interest rates are low and more stimulus is required? At its core, the answer is pretty straightforward. Rely on the cash rate target first and foremost. Use additional tools if necessary. In Australia and elsewhere, additional tools have generally been used once the policy rate's already been constrained. But they could also be used alongside cuts in the cash rate towards zero in order to front load support and perhaps reduce reliance on those additional tools later on. More broadly, when interest rates are already low, the Monetary Policy Board may have less tolerance for inflation falling below the 2 to 3% target. In those circumstances, it may consider responding earlier and more decisively to disinflationary shocks by preemptively lowering the cash rate target. So such a response may indeed reduce the need to rely on alternative tools, but they can still provide valuable support in extraordinary times. So let me highlight three ways in which we'd approach their use. I think first and foremost, the purpose must be clear and communicated clearly. We'd explain why particular tools had been chosen, recognising that their effectiveness depends very much on the context. A tool that works well in some circumstances may be much less effective in others, depending on the nature of the shock and the conditions in the economy and financial markets. We'd also distinguish clearly between tools used for monetary policy purposes and then those used to support market functioning or financial stability. So in practice, those two motives can overlap, and if they do, we'd clearly say so, because ambiguity reduces effectiveness and makes exit harder. Tools aimed at stimulating aggregate demand, those are typically larger, they're longer lasting, right, with greater implications, therefore, for the consolidated balance sheet and entailing a wider range of risks. So we need to be deliberate and clear in how we'd use those. So I think the second thing is that decision making needs to be dynamic. Tools should be assessed and reassessed over their full life cycle across a range of scenarios and subject to robust review and challenge. And this reflects two realities. The benefits often come early, while the costs build over time, and we're unlikely to calibrate the responses exactly right in real time. Hence, just as with the cash rate target, settings for alternative monetary policy tools will need to be revisited as conditions evolve. And third, exit strategies need to be considered from the very outset. There can be a trade-off between effectiveness and flexibility. A strong commitment may make a tool much more stimulatory, but also much harder to unwind if the economy evolves differently from that expected. We would set out how the exit would be determined as part of the design of any tool or package. So let me turn now to some lessons I drew from the pandemic. As I said earlier, the framework draws on lessons from our recent experience during that time. The pandemic showed that a package of additional tools can provide valuable support in extraordinary times, but success depends on the context. It also highlighted important challenges in the design, the calibration, communication, exit, and broader risk management of the tools. And these lessons are reflected in the approach that we've set out. Be clear about the purpose of each tool. Reassess decisions over time as conditions evolve. And consider the full life cycle of a tool at the outset, including risks and exit strategies. To make these lessons more concrete, I think it's helpful to consider the use of additional policy tools during the pandemic, and I'm going to start with the term funding facility. The term funding facility helped calm Australian funding markets during a period of what was severe global stress. It supported also the pass-through of low policy rates. It lowered funding costs for lenders, and hence it contributed to much lower rates for borrowers. At the same time, the facility underscored the trade-off between support for the economy and policy flexibility. while the low fixed rate and fixed term of the facility reinforced other parts of the policy package, it provided no flexibility on the amount of stimulus. It also introduced interest rate risk for the RBA and the consolidated public sector balance sheet. Now, a variable rate facility would have involved less financial risk, indeed it was considered at the time, but it could have also been less stimulatory. In any case, that option wasn't readily available at the time for operational reasons, although now it is. So this experience shows the value of testing a wider range of scenarios, including faster than expected recoveries. With more weight on upside economic scenarios, it's plausible that we might have reached different decisions, including, for example, on the extension to the term funding facility in September of 2020. It also highlighted the importance of the close consultation we had at the time with APRA and our engagement with the banks, particularly as the facility matured. A key system-wide risk is that a lot of banks may need to replace that type of funding all at the same time, and that could create pressure in private funding markets. So in sum, term funding facilities can ease financial conditions, can support the economy, but the outcomes depend importantly on their design and the broader context. So what about the government bond purchase program? Well, they've been particularly effective when markets have been impaired. Bond purchase programs can support market functioning and reduce liquidity premium, thereby restoring the transmission of monetary policy. And that was certainly part of the logic and the thinking for the RBA's early bond purchases in the pandemic in 2020. However, the effect on aggregate demand of a much longer-lived bond purchase program is probably weaker here in Australia than in some of our peer economies. While the pandemic-era program provided some support, the estimated effects for Australia were at the lower end of international evidence. And that probably reflects both the broader policy package in place at the time, but also some structural features of our economy. Namely, borrowing is largely bank-based, and most of it's linked to shorter-term rates, so the lower longer-term yields that the bond purchase program tries to bring about are less relevant to overall borrowing costs. Bond purchase could also put pressure on the Aussie dollar, downward pressure on the Aussie dollar, but the extent of that's uncertain and depends in part on the policies of other central banks. Large-scale bond purchase programs also expose the RBA's balance sheet, and therefore the consolidated public sector balance sheet, to financial risk because they involve funding fixed-rate assets with floating-rate liabilities. And if the policy rate needs to rise significantly later on, those risks become mark-to-market losses. These effects should be considered as part of a broader assessment of the impact on the consolidated balance sheet, including the extent to which stronger economic activity supports tax revenues. Anyway, taken together, I think experience suggests in Australia government bond purchase programs are most effective as a targeted tool to restore market functioning in periods of stress. And in some circumstances, they can also support activity, but their use should be guided by the limits and associated risks of such purchases. So what about forward guidance? Well, forward guidance in what I'm describing as a stronger form, that involves committing to keep policy easier than otherwise, either until specific economic outcomes are achieved or until a specific date is reached. When that commitment's clear, when it's credible, when it's well understood, it can contribute to easier financial conditions. However, this strong form of forward guidance, particularly a time-based one, is vulnerable to changing economic conditions under which the best response in the future may well differ from your initial commitment. And the pandemic showed just how hard it can be to communicate conditionality and how reputational costs can arise in such circumstances as circumstances change. In our case, this was made harder by the interaction with the yield target and the term funding facility, which were both firmly anchored in time-based commitments. So the implication is that forward guidance with commitment can support the economy, but it's difficult to implement in practice and is generally advisable for it to be explicitly conditioned on economic outcomes rather than tied to a fixed date. That experience also reinforced two broader lessons. First, communication in exceptional times is more effective when there's a clear and well-understood reaction function in normal times. And second, communication needs to be embedded in policy design right from the outset, particularly when multiple tools are deployed together. The challenge is not just how forward guidance is communicated, but how it's designed, how it interacts with other policy tools, how it's understood publicly. So now let me turn to the bond yield target that we had. A yield target can help support markets, and they are when they're under strain and contribute to lower funding costs. Indeed, the three-year yield target helped achieve exactly that very early on in the pandemic, alongside the broader pandemic policy package. But a yield target's not well suited to a highly uncertain environment where the outlook can change significantly. And as our experience showed, it shares many of the same challenges as forward guidance, with the added complication of material risks to the balance sheet for the RBA. There can also be risks to market functioning, which we were quite attuned to at the time, especially though if the exit is disorderly. Overall, yield targets require particular caution. They may have a role in exceptional circumstances, but only with a clear understanding of the risks, a careful scenario analysis, and a credible exit strategy from the outset. In short, pulling all of this together, I think the most important support during the pandemic came from lowering the cash rate target to historically low levels and keeping it there. Additional tools can reinforce that sort of support, but their effects, beyond addressing severe market strains, are likely to be more marginal, and their risks need to be managed carefully. The framework that we published considers some other tools. It considers negative interest rates and purchases of foreign exchange assets. The RBA didn't use those tools during the pandemic, but they have been discussed publicly in the past, and they were certainly used in peer economies. Their inclusion in the framework, I think, reflects the need for a considered view of all the options and their limits. Negative interest rates could, in principle, provide some additional stimulus, but over time they can impair market functioning, add to financial stability vulnerabilities, and weaken monetary policy transmission. They also pose significant operational and communication challenges, and they've proven deeply unpopular where they've been used. Even so, there may be circumstances where they are useful. In particular, the experience in some other smaller open economies suggests they can help resist appreciation pressures, especially when your large trading partner partners have adopted negative interest rates. Foreign exchange asset purchases, they could support aggregate demand by putting sustained downward pressure on the Australian dollar, or by resisting appreciation at least. Now, that's quite different from the sort of short-term intervention that the bank's undertaken in the past to address disorderly market conditions. But the Australian dollar is a very liquid currency. It trades in very deep markets. So to have a meaningful macro effect, the RBA would probably need to undertake very large purchases of foreign exchange and take on substantial risk to the balance sheet. So while those two tools are still in the toolkit, I expect they'd only be considered in truly exceptional circumstances. So what about next steps? The RBA's framework for additional monetary policy tools at low interest rates completes a review recommendation. More importantly, it puts us in a stronger position to respond in the rare circumstances when the cash rate is very low and additional support may be needed. To reiterate, though, the cash rate target remains our primary and preferred instrument for achieving our inflation and employment objectives. But there may be times when conventional policy space is constrained and additional support is needed. In those cases, the new framework makes us better placed to respond. But there's still some more to do. An important next step, for example, is to run fire drills, and we're going to be doing that in time with the Monetary Policy Board, the Governance Board, and the RBA staff. And those drills are intended to test the framework, our internal readiness, and help us make decisions under time pressure and with incomplete information. The other thing to recognize finally is that the framework's not static. It's going to be updated as we learn from those exercises, as we learn from further research and from international experience and our own experience if we have any future use of these tools. Other tools could be considered over time as well. And while the next crisis will definitely not look like the past, we'll at least be better prepared to respond to it. So let me actually thank and welcome Michelle Lewis up to the stage. Michelle's going to help moderate the session and was a key architect and author of much of the work that sits in behind the framework. And also, thanks for contributing to my speech.
Great.
All errors were mine, though. So, Michelle, I'm in your hands.
Thank you very much.
And please, looking forward to questions, including quite a few people online, I believe.
Yes. So for those in the room, we'll have two options. So one will be a microphone, which will be passed around. The other option is you can use Slido, and then those questions will be fed into the rest of the audience who is online who can also ask questions using Slido. But first of all, let's start with questions in the room. And maybe I will start off while you gather your questions. So the first question would be, this is quite a fulsome framework from both a process and a governance perspective. Are you concerned that it could slow the Monetary Policy Board down?
No, indeed. I think if anything, the opposite. The whole idea of the framework is to draw in a timely way all of the lessons, which we'd already tried to draw on each of the tools that we had used during the pandemic, but do that more fulsomely and look at everyone's experience and bring in these external perspectives, which were extremely helpful. And then get the Monetary Policy Board and the Governance Board familiar with the framework, the principles, the process that we'd go through, and start to even think a bit about some of the tools and their pluses and minuses. So I think, if anything, having this framework doesn't slow the process. I think it will speed, sort of allow us to make timely decisions. And sometimes those decisions have to be made under considerable time pressure, depending on the nature of whatever crisis we might face in the future.
Yes. There's a microphone coming.
Hi, thanks both for your explanations there. Rob Thompson from RBC. Just a quick one on the framework here. Was there any ever discussion of entirely ruling out any of these options, or were they always all going to be on the table for future episodes? Particularly referring to the yield curve target, I suppose, and discussions there.
Yeah. Look, I think starting back with the, so after the various tools that we used during the pandemic, after they'd sort of rolled off and we had a bit of time, but before too much time had passed, we did a review of each and every one of them. And then this framework sort of brings all of that together again and has a fresh look at it. And I think even at the time with that individual review just of the yield target by itself, we gave a sense that it was problematic for the reasons that are outlined in the framework and that I outlined in my speech. But I just think you never want to entirely rule things out.
Too much forward guidance.
Well, it's a bit, it's more that you don't need to tie your hands. And look, I think the yield target was an important and valuable part of the package. And we've got to be careful because hindsight is always perfect. But there were aspects where maybe the yield target could have been configured and used and been more effective than it had been at the time and less problematic in particular. It may have been that we didn't have to, if you'd have your time again and you still had a yield target, you might not have rolled it forward as readily as we did, for example. So I know we really don't want to rule things out. And that's why even I wanted to mention those other tools. You just wouldn't want to rule them out.
You mentioned the reviewers earlier. Can you talk us through what their key contributions were?
Yeah, so look, they were really helpful. We had some sort of draft work and thinking together, and we provided it to them, and they came into the bank, came to Australia indeed, and came down to Sydney and met with staff. They met with all the senior executives, including the governors, for some time in February. And what they did was they tested the key issues that we put before them, all of our assumptions and our design choices. I think the main thing they brought out was that fourth principle that I've sort of discussed, to think about broader public policies and how our use of additional tools might have an effect on other agencies and how we would want to best take account of our effect on them and what they're doing as well. I mean, those were always sort of there at the back of our minds, but I think they made us crystallise that a lot more clearly. So we added those sort of that consideration of policy settings across the public sector agencies. They also just wanted us to drill down and be a bit clearer about the role of uncertainty, the distinction between using tools for market dysfunction versus using tools over a longer period to really drive financial conditions into an easier place. They wanted us to talk about and think about scenarios, communication, and even the fire drills.
Great. I think we had a question.
Chris, Phil Adoni from Deutsche Bank. Thank you so much for your remarks this morning. I wanted to ask you, in the section where you talk about the term funding facility, the fixed term funding facility introduced in COVID, you've said that there is a variable rate facility, would involve less financial risk. That wasn't available at the time, but it is now. What do you mean, just a bit more colour on what you mean by a variable rate facility? I presume it's fixed for some term, perhaps not 3 years, but what? Just more colour.
So you could... you could do it a little bit like our OMO rates now, just over a longer period of time. So when you bid at OMO, at our open market operations on a Wednesday, you don't know what rate you'll be paying, you just know it'll be paid out according to how markets behave over a period of time for which you have that. So you could have done that sort of thing in theory. In practice, we weren't really ready for that operationally, nor were the market. But at the same time, I think even if we had, I think the thinking was we'd never face circumstances like this globally in modern times. We were facing a financial crisis of real substance. It passed very quickly, but I think it passed because central banks and governments acted quite quickly. And central banks acted very quickly, because, you know, we had the most critical market in the world economy, the US Treasury market, just grinding down to almost to a halt, and other government bond markets were doing a similar thing. So I think at the time we thought, no, we have to go all out here. We have to provide a lot of support. That will come at some cost. But a fixed rate with a long fixed term was actually going to provide the sort of support the economy needed, particularly when we'd had years of undershooting the inflation target. I think that came into mind as well. So if we'd been able to flick a switch and have variable rate term funding facility, I don't know that we would have done it even at that time.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. And then Joe's got a question. We've got a few in the room, so that's good. Slido might have to work harder. But Michelle,
yeah, of course.
Sorry, I should let you direct traffic.
Yes. Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ken. I'm Ken Crompton from National Australia Bank. Probably a bit of a derivative of Phil's question, but there's a common theme across downsides to a lot of the tools here of the mark-to-market cost or the carry cost or those sort of things. I mean, you know, in the long run, a central bank can obviously have negative equity and survive quite well, but that does turn up as a negative for all these policies. To what extent is that a limitation in what the RBA may do going forward? Has that concern changed due to that particular issue getting a little bit of an airing in a few sort of media and parliamentary circles over the past couple of years?
I think it's not so much that. I think it's more thinking about the decision-making process, the risk management process, and the governance process. So particularly now we've focused our minds, we have a governance board that is responsible for managing the bank's risks. Now, the Monetary Policy Board has a different lens and a different need. It needs to focus it, do what's best for the economy, and it will do that. But in formulating those policies, if there are different options that are available to it, the governance board would direct it and direct it, but like it to have take the one that provides similar stimulus, for example, but has less cost to the bank. Now, the challenge here, of course, is you often, through a bond purchase program, the whole idea here is you're taking risk off private balance sheets and putting them on the public balance sheet, which can wear those in order to provide that sort of stimulus. So it necessarily implies the potential to make losses. But what the framework's doing is just say, yes, but document those carefully, think through scenarios that could be more adverse for the balance sheet, and consider all of those things when drawing conclusions, putting a package together. So it's not ruling them out by any means. It's just saying, let's follow a slightly more thorough, considered approach. And if we do that ahead of time, including in these fire drills, we'll be better placed to make good decisions. I'm not saying the decisions at the time were the wrong ones. When the Reserve Bank Board made the decision to buy bonds at the time, they were aware of these risks. But I don't think they considered quite the upside scenarios that you might want to now. Again, hindsight, right? It's perfect. You now know you need to consider the possibility of a major incursion in Europe that forces oil prices and energy prices up dramatically in, for example.
Okay. Question.
Good morning. Michael Tang from CBA. I can see in the heat map in the framework for additional monetary policy tools at lower interest rates, so that's table four, you can see that term lending facilities is almost unambiguously better or perhaps suitable relative to the other tools. Is it fair to say that that'll sort of be the first choice of tool? And I guess an alternative question as well is, you know, are there circumstances where perhaps some of the other tools might be preferred ahead of term lending facilities?
Well, I think if, so as I tried to emphasise in my speech, the absolute most important tool is the cash rate target. So that's first and foremost. And possibly even doing that somewhat preemptively in order to avoid even being stuck at or getting to the effective lower bound and needing to use other tools. I think I wouldn't be nearly as strong as what you've suggested. I think it does depend on the circumstances. I mean, it was a key plank of the initial package. The initial package didn't involve bond purchases, partly for the reasons I talked about, because at the time, and we'd done some reviews using some BIS studies which pulled together central bank experience during the GFC. At the time, we didn't think the bond purchase program was going to be as powerful or as, and it would potentially be more costly because of Australia's, the nature of Australia's financial system. And being very bank-based, something like a term lending facility can be very powerful. Because when you're in a real crisis, you not only want to reduce the cost of funding, you want to make sure there is funding being provided to businesses and households. When you're very bank-based, something that goes direct to the source like that can be quite effective. But I don't think I'd be nearly as strong as you've suggested.
Thanks, Chris. Jo Masters from Barrenjoey. I also just had a question about the heat map. Mm-hmm. So thanks for that.
That's the one thing I didn't print out in front of me, but I've got it in my memory.
I can show you mine.
I might come and take it from you if needed.
It's a really great summary. I noticed, though, each of these tools have been assessed individually. And in your speech, you've talked a lot about the package, the interaction of these, with the cash rate being at the centre of that. Have you done work about which combination of these may be most effective in any given scenario?
I don't think we have. I'll just check with Michelle. We haven't really got to that point.
So in the latter part of the framework, we do talk about we need to consider tool interactions. And in the staff assessments, more detailed assessment that's been published alongside, we talk about it in a bit more detail there. But I think that's when the fire drills and the scenario analysis, that's when we're really going to bring that to life.
But I think it can be quite hard, because it's quite hard to incorporate these in your standard macroeconomic models, for example. And I think it really will depend on the circumstances at the time. The one thing actually, and just going back to the previous one, but the two questions blend together quite well, the one thing I sort of forgot. Now, this isn't so much about a tool that you use when interest rates are very low, but the one thing we did very, very quickly is provide a lot of liquidity. We immediately altered our operations at the time, which were quite limited. They're not like they are today. We essentially turned them to be very close to what we have today, almost like full allotment. And we did that quite live. I remember it during one of the sessions where we decided we were going to up the amount we were offering banks on that morning dealing from numbers like 2 billion to 10. And then we just saw the demand and we just live during the auction decided, right, we're going to just provide everybody what they asked for at the price they asked for it. So it turned it into a full allotment auction. So lots of liquidity came in. That's a really important thing to marry with reducing, in a crisis, reducing the policy rate. I think the other thing we did is we did bond purchases. Now, some of them came through the yield target, but we did bond purchases before. We started that process very early on to try and alleviate the stresses that were running through all of the markets that I talked about earlier when I was discussing with Phil. So, you know, I think it's hard, though, to sort of know exactly what circumstances you'll face and run those. The challenge will be to model us now and into the future to see if they can do that. But even then, I suspect that you're going to sort of have to assess the circumstances at the time and think about the different sort of market conditions you're facing. And in a bank-based system, if the banks are under stress and facing prospect of not being able to raise funds internationally or even domestically in bond markets, then that's why a term funding facility might be particularly useful, but it might be very different circumstances from that.
Okay, we'll let some people online jump in. So Jonathan Kearns has a question. Chris, how often do you expect that these additional tools might be used? If the neutral cash rate estimate is, say, around 3.6% and developed economy central banks historically cut by around 400 basis points in a recession, there seems to be a fair chance that they will be needed.
Yeah, so I think it's a good question from Jonathan. Not surprising, really. And this has been an issue for some time. Indeed, it was an issue out of the global financial crisis. So the issue is, if neutral rates are coming down, sort of the what rate would sort of sustain an economy at the inflation target at full employment is a lower rate over time, you're that much closer to hitting something like an effective lower bound if you think negative rates aren't particularly useful in your economy. So if that's the case, I guess there's a few things you could do. One, I suggested in the speech, is you might be cognizant of that and be very careful when there are disinflationary pressures and rates are already low to be maybe a bit more reactive than you might otherwise be. Yes, you might feel the need to bring in some additional support from these other tools. It may just be the reality that we face, though, that if that's the case. Two points. One, I think, is the wrong one. At the time, a former professor of mine, Stan Fisher, and a colleague of mine that I went to school with and was at the IMF were wondering, should you raise the inflation target? Because that raises your nominal neutral rate and takes you further away from the effective lower bound. I think that's quite dangerous, because if people think you can move your inflation target around, you'll move it as it suits. It does argue slightly in the favour of having 2.5 versus 2. So I think it's a very strong argument not to change the target to 2 in Australia. The other perspective is maybe there are other things that other branches of the public sector can do to try and boost productivity. And anything we do to boost productivity might help with the neutral rate, push that a bit higher. But that's not something central banks can control.
Hi, Chris. Stella from Reuters. So buying a bonds basically left you with large paper losses and made you technically bankrupt. Have you considered ways you could buy bonds without such risks, maybe getting the government to cover any losses?
Yeah, I don't think a central bank can become bankrupt, so I just challenge that premise so people don't think I agree with you on that. I think what you're really talking about is indemnities, and I think it's a good question. I think it would be something that you would imagine if the Monetary Policy Board was deciding to pursue a significant bond purchase program, for example, or something else that put the balance sheet at considerable risk. On the one hand, they're thinking, well, we do that because our assessment of the benefit for the macroeconomy far outweighs what risk there might be to the bank's balance sheet. But it should still be something that they take into account explicitly, and I would imagine there'd be conversations with the government on the day. These things were considered during the pandemic. Would we go and ask for something like an indemnity at that time? And the decision was no, partly because we thought not asking strengthened our hand in terms of our longer-term central bank independence. It strengthened our hand in trying to say to the market and to everybody else, we're buying in the secondary market. It's at arm's length from the government. And then the other experience is it's varied with those who did have indemnities, the perceived value. So in terms of the cost to the bank's reputation and to the balance sheet, that was all that was always revealed fairly quickly in our case because of the way we mark to market. And then we've moved on from that and people have seen, well, the central bank's been able to do everything it needs to do, even with negative equity. And of course, there is a plan to rebuild that, and that's coming. But the one thing I would sort of note, if you have to go into the public domain and to your fiscal authorities every month and say, this is the bill for the month, then that's not so great either. Right. The most important thing, I think, is for everyone to recognise when you use these tools, they're not without risk. And the risk is not only to the central bank balance sheet, but as I said multiple times in the speech, to the consolidated public sector balance sheet. So I think as long as you're very clear about that and note and say, well, if we're doing it, we still think it's for the economy's benefit, well, so be it. There's a question over here, unless you wanted to go to
Sorry, we can do one in the room first.
Thank you, Chris, for the speech. Matt Squires from TCorp. I'm just curious, you talk about the risks to the consolidated balance sheet, and you've talked a bit about the exit of some of these additional tools. Does the framework consider, once the objectives have been met, any more active reduction in the RBA's balance sheet, or is hiking the cash rate always going to be the preferred option?
It's a good question. I think when we've looked at this in the past, and Michelle can correct me, I'm sure that if... I think the evidence is that the effect you have on yields and on market functioning, the transmission of monetary policy, but by pursuing something like bond purchases, for example, tend to be strongest when the economy is already quite weak and struggling and needs that support. But then if you needed to really tighten policy, just starting and doing it through, say, a quantitative active sales of bonds, an active QT program, I think that's possibly going to be less effective in raising rates to the extent you need to. And that's certainly the path we followed this time around. And I think that's probably worked about as well as we could have hoped. And we've looked at that thoroughly over a period of time. Would we actively sell bonds? We decided no in our circumstances, that we didn't think that was necessary. Might be quite different circumstances if you were purchasing bonds not so much for financial conditions to make them easier under a bond purchase program, but to address market dysfunction. I think the general consensus is you say we're going to come in and buy while the market needs support. But depending on the nature of that circumstance, if it's not a broad economic crisis that's going to last for a long time, the intention, I think, would be, and the Bank of England did this reasonably well, I think, to sell the bond shortly thereafter, which is not unlike a foreign exchange intervention, which we've done in the distant past.
Yeah, all right. We've got a few minutes left, so I'll just go to some questions that are online, and then we'll see if there are any last ones in the room. So from Shane Wright, Chris, in the speech, you note that the Monetary Policy Board may act earlier and more decisively to deal with the disinflationary situation. Going back to the 2019-2020 period, when the bank moved the cash rate down from an already low 1.5%, how much lower could the bank move, and would it mean larger cuts?
Well, I think I suggest it's a good question, Shane. I think I suggested in the speech, our analysis suggests, while you cannot rule out negative rates in Australia, they're probably not one of the first tools or even the tools you'd regularly consider. So going back to these circumstances, I think a bit the review of the RBA and looking back over period, even before the 2019-20 period, the question was, you've been under target for a while, maybe the suggestion is, and again, hindsight's always perfect, you've been a bit more aggressive, even leading up to the pandemic, to raise inflation, and that might have been a better course. Now, again, it's easier to say that with hindsight, but that's I think, one of the lessons learned. Be careful, and as my question from Jonathan suggests, be careful getting too close to zero if you think it's because of, if inflation's low and you can provide some more stimulus. But you have to consider the circumstances at the time. I think it's hard to say.
Okay. Here's another question from Sophia Rodriguez. So this framework is about monetary policy at low interest rates. So Sophia's question is more about, it's just disappeared. Here we go. I'm wondering if we'd also need additional tools at high nominal interest rates because inflation is elevated. And this is because the cash rate might not solely be, the cash rate solely may not be effective. Mm. Has any thought been given to this?
I think I'm not sure if this is quite what Sophia's meaning, but I think there's a general sense in, can't we do something else? Because the cash rate, when it's high, hits really hard those who have a mortgage. And I think that's natural in an economy like Australia, where we have variable rate mortgages, and so the effect is quite instantaneous, and the effect is quite obvious. What we've said in the past, though, is that probably overstates the role of the cash flow channel. That is, people who have a mortgage, their cash flows are impacted, they have to pull in their spending. It seems there are other channels that are equally, if not much more important in Australia, the cash flow. The effect that interest rates have on dwelling investment, tangentially through business investment, through the Aussie dollar, and then the so-called intertemporal effect, where everybody has an incentive to consume less and save more when interest rates are high. So I think my answer is, look, the cash rate's a pretty effective tool when you're trying to address high inflation, and monetary policy is the right approach. So no, Sophia, I wouldn't be using other tools.
All right, any final question in the room? Okay, we'll go one more on the line. This one's been here for a little while. So does the RBA ever intend to do a sale of its AGS holdings?
They're coming down reasonably quickly and aren't particularly substantial now, particularly when you think about the sort of residual maturity of these bonds. We looked at it long and hard. We considered it over a number of different board meetings, and we've come out with the decision earlier that passive QT, just letting them roll off, is sufficient for our needs. So no obvious burning platform, I think, to sell bonds.
Okay, that brings the Q&A part to a close. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here today. And there'll be a full transcript online later this afternoon.
Thanks for all your questions. Thanks for coming along. And thanks for all those online. Cheers. Bye.